I think this should be enough to make the matter clear. The accusation of espionage against the Poom rested solely upon articles in the communist press and the activities of the communist-controlled secret police. The Poom leaders, and hundreds or thousands of their followers, are still in prison, and for 6 months past, the communist press has continued to clamour for the execution of the traitors. But Negrín and the others have kept their heads and refused to stage a wholesale massacre of Trotskyists. Considering the pressure that has been put upon them, it is greatly to their credit that they have done so. Meanwhile, in the face of what I've quoted above, it becomes very difficult to believe that the Poom was really a fascist spying organization, unless one also believes that Maxton, McGovern, Prieto, Irujo, Zugazagoyitia, and the rest are all in fascist pay together. Finally, as to the charge that the Poom was Trotskyist. This word is now flung about with greater and greater freedom, and it is used in a way that is extremely misleading and is often intended to mislead. It is worth stopping to define it. The word Trotskyist is used to mean three distinct things. One who, like Trotsky, advocates world revolution as against socialism in a single country, more loosely, a revolutionary extremist. Two, a member of the actual organization of which Trotsky is head. Three, a disguised fascist posing as a revolutionary who acts especially by sabotage in the USSR, but in general by splitting and undermining the left-wing forces. In sense, one, the Poom could probably be described as Trotskyist. So can the English ILP, the German SAP, the left socialists in France, and so on. But the Poom had no connection with Trotsky or the Trotskyist Bolshevik-Leninist organization. When the war broke out, the foreign Trotskyists who came to Spain, 15 or 20 in number, worked at first for the Poom as the party nearest to their own viewpoint, but without becoming party members. Later, Trotsky ordered his followers to attack the Poom policy, and the Trotskyists were purged from the party offices, though a few remained in the militia. Nin, the Poom leader, after Morin's capture by the fascists, was at one time Trotsky's secretary, but had left him some years earlier and formed the Poom by the amalgamation of various opposition communists with an earlier party, the Workers and Peasants Bloc. Nin's one-time association with Trotsky has been used in the communist press to show that the Poom was really Trotskyist. By the same line of argument, it can be shown that the English Communist Party is really a fascist organization because of Mr. John Strachey's one-time association with Sir Oswald Mosley. In a sense, too, the only exactly defined sense of the word, the Poom was certainly not Trotskyist. It is important to make this distinction because it is taken for granted by the majority of communists that a Trotskyist in sense two is invariably a Trotskyist in sense three, i.e. that the whole Trotskyist organization is simply a fascist spying machine. Trotskyism only came into public notice in the time of the Russian sabotage trials, and to call a man a Trotskyist is practically equivalent to calling him a murderer, agent provocateur, etc. But at the same time, anyone who criticizes communist policy from a left-wing standpoint is liable to be denounced as a Trotskyist. Is it then asserted that everyone professing revolutionary extremism is in fascist pay? In practice it is, or is not, according to local convenience. When Maxton went to Spain with the delegation I've mentioned above, Verdad, Frente Rojo, and other Spanish communist papers instantly denounced him as a Trotsky fascist, spy of the Gestapo, and so forth. Yet the English communists were careful not to repeat this accusation. In the English communist press, Maxton becomes merely a reactionary enemy of the working class, which is conveniently vague. The reason, of course, is simply that several sharp lessons have given the English communist press a wholesome dread of the law of libel. The fact that the accusation was not repeated in a country where it might have to be proved is sufficient confession that it is a lie. It may seem that I've discussed the accusations against the Poom at greater length than was necessary. Compared with the huge miseries of a civil war, this kind of internecine squabble between parties, with its inevitable injustices and false accusations, may appear trivial. It is not really so. I believe that libels and press campaigns of this kind, and the habits of mind they indicate, are capable of doing the most deadly damage to the anti-fascist cause. Anyone who has given the subject a glance knows that the communist tactic of dealing with political opponents by means of trumped-up accusations is nothing new. Today the key word is Trotsky fascist, yesterday it was social fascist. It is only 6 or 7 years since the Russian state trials proved that the leaders of the Second International, including, for instance, Leon Blum and prominent members of the British Labour Party, were hatching a huge plot for the military invasion of the USSR. Yet today, the French communists are glad enough to accept Blum as a leader, and the English communists are raising heaven and earth to get inside the Labour Party. I doubt whether this kind of thing pays, even from a sectarian point of view. And meanwhile, there is no possible doubt about the hatred and dissension that the Trotsky fascist accusation is causing. Rank-and-file communists everywhere are led away on a senseless witch hunt after Trotskyists, and parties of the type of the Poom are driven back into the terribly sterile position of being mere anti-communist parties. There is already the beginning of a dangerous split in the world working-class movement. A few more libels against lifelong socialists, a few more frame-ups like the charges against the Poom, and the split may become irreconcilable. The only hope is to keep political controversy on a plane where exhaustive discussion is possible. Between the communists and those who stand or claim to stand to the left of them, there is a real difference. The communists hold that fascism can be beaten by alliance with sections of the capitalist class, the Popular Front. Their opponents hold that this manoeuvre simply gives fascism new breeding grounds. The question has got to be settled. To make the wrong decision may be to land ourselves in for centuries of semi-slavery. But so long as no argument is produced except a scream of Trotsky fascist, the discussion cannot even begin. It would be impossible for me, for instance, to debate the rights and wrongs of the Barcelona fighting with a Communist Party member. Because no communist, that is to say no good communist, could admit that I have given a truthful account of the facts. If he followed his party line dutifully, he would have to declare that I am lying, or at best that I am hopelessly misled, and that anyone who glanced at the Daily Worker headlines 1,000 miles from the scene of events knows more of what was happening in Barcelona than I do. In such circumstances, there can be no argument. The necessary minimum of agreement cannot be reached. What purpose is served by saying that men like Maxton are in fascist pay? Only the purpose of making serious discussion impossible. It is as though, in the middle of a chess tournament, one competitor should suddenly begin screaming that the other is guilty of arson or bigamy. The point that is really at issue remains untouched. Libel settles nothing. Chapter 12. It must have been 3 days after the Barcelona fighting ended that we returned to the front. After the fighting, more particularly after the slanging match in the newspapers, it was difficult to think about this war in quite the same naively idealistic manner as before. I suppose there's no one who spent more than a few weeks in Spain without being in some degree disillusioned. My mind went back to the newspaper correspondent whom I had met my first day in Barcelona, and who said to me, "This war is a racket the same as any other." The remark had shocked me deeply, and at that time, December, I do not believe it was true. It was not true even now in May, but it was becoming truer. The fact is that every war suffers a kind of progressive degradation with every month that it continues, because such things as individual liberty and a truthful press are simply not compatible with military efficiency. One could begin now to make some kind of guess at what was likely to happen. It was easy to see that the Caballero government would fall and be replaced by a more right-wing government with a stronger communist influence. This happened a week or two later, which would set itself to break the power of the trade unions once and for all. And afterwards, when Franco was beaten, and putting aside the huge problems raised by the reorganization of Spain, the prospect was not rosy. As for the newspaper talk about this being a war for democracy, it was plain eyewash. No one in his senses supposed that there was any hope of democracy, even as we understand it in England or France, in a country so divided and exhausted as Spain would be when the war was over. It would have to be a dictatorship, and it was clear that the chance of a working-class dictatorship had passed. That meant that the general movement would be in the direction of some kind of fascism. Fascism called, no doubt, by some politer name, and because this was Spain more human and less efficient than the German or Italian varieties. The only alternatives were an infinitely worse dictatorship by Franco, or, always a possibility, that the war would end with Spain divided up, either by actual frontiers or into economic zones. Whichever way you took it, it was a depressing outlook. But it did not follow that the government was not worth fighting for, as against the more naked and developed fascism of Franco and Hitler. Whatever faults the post-war government might have, Franco's regime would certainly be worse. To the workers, the town proletariat, it might, in the end, make very little difference who won. But Spain is primarily an agricultural country, and the peasants would almost certainly benefit by a government victory. Some, at least, of the seized lands would remain in their possession, in which case there would also be a distribution of land in the territory that had been Franco's, and the virtual serfdom that had existed in some parts of Spain was not likely to be restored. The government in control at the end of the war would at any rate be anti-clerical and anti-feudal. It would keep the church in check, at least for the time being, and would modernize the country, build roads, for instance, and promote education and public health. A certain amount had been done in this direction even during the war. Franco, on the other hand, insofar as he was not merely the puppet of Italy and Germany, was tied to the big feudal landlords and stood for a stuffy clerico-military reaction. The Popular Front might be a swindle, but Franco was an anachronism. Only millionaires or romantics could want him to win. Moreover, there was the question of the international prestige of fascism, which for a year or two past had been haunting me like a nightmare. Since 1930, the fascists had won all the victories. It was time they got a beating. It hardly mattered from whom. If we could drive Franco and his foreign mercenaries into the sea, it might make an immense improvement in the world situation. Even if Spain itself emerged with a stifling dictatorship and all its best men in jail, for that alone the war would have been worth winning. This was how I saw things at the time. I may say that I now think much more highly of the Negrín government than I did when it came into office. It has kept up the difficult fight with splendid courage, and it has shown more political tolerance than anyone expected, but I still believe that, unless Spain splits up with unpredictable consequences, the tendency of the post-war government is bound to be fascistic. Once again, I let this opinion stand, and take the chance that time will do to me what it does to most prophets. We had just reached the front when we heard that Bob Smilly, on his way back to England, had been arrested at the frontier, taken down to Valencia, and thrown into jail. Smilly had been in Spain since the previous October. He had worked for several months at the PUM office and had then joined the militia when the other ILP members arrived, on the understanding that he was to do 3 months at the front before going back to England to take part in a propaganda tour. It was some time before we could discover what he had been arrested for. He was being kept incommunicado, so that not even a lawyer could see him. In Spain, there is, at any rate in practice, no habeas corpus, and you can be kept in jail for months at a stretch without even being charged, let alone tried. Finally, we learned from a released prisoner that Smilly had been arrested for carrying arms. The arms, as I happen to know, were two hand grenades of the primitive type used at the beginning of the war, which he had been taking home to show off at his lectures, along with shell splinters and other souvenirs. The charges and fuses had been removed from them. They were mere cylinders of steel and completely harmless. It was obvious that this was only a pretext, and that he had been arrested because of his known connection with the Poom. The Barcelona fighting had only just ended, and the authorities were, at that moment, extremely anxious not to let anyone out of Spain who was in a position to contradict the official version. As a result, people were liable to be arrested at the frontier on more or less frivolous pretexts. Very possibly the intention at the beginning was only to detain Smilly for a few days, but the trouble is that in Spain, once you're in jail, you generally stay there, with or without trial. We were still at Huesca, but they had placed us further to the right, opposite the fascist redoubt, which we had temporarily captured a few weeks earlier. I was now acting as teniente, corresponding to second lieutenant of the British Army, I suppose, in command of about 30 men, English and Spanish. They had sent my name in for a regular commission. Whether I should get it was uncertain. Previously, the militia officers had refused to accept regular commissions, which meant extra pay, and conflicted with the equalitarian ideas of the militia, but they were now obliged to do so. Benjamin had already been gazetted captain, and Cop was in the process of being gazetted major. The government could not, of course, dispense with the militia officers, but it was not confirming any of them in a higher rank than major, presumably in order to keep the higher commands for regular army officers and the new officers from the School of War. As a result, in our division, the 29th, and no doubt in many others, you had the queer temporary situation of the divisional commander, the brigade commanders and the battalion commanders, all being majors. There was not much happening at the front. The battle round the Harker Road had died away and did not begin again till mid-June. In our position, the chief trouble was the snipers. The fascist trenches were more than 150 yards away, but they were on higher ground and were on two sides of us, our line forming a right-angle salient. The corner of the salient was a dangerous spot. There had always been a toll of sniper casualties there. From time to time, the fascists let fly at us with a rifle grenade or some similar weapon. It made a ghastly crash, unnerving because you couldn't hear it coming in time to dodge, but was not really dangerous. The hole it blew in the ground was no bigger than a wash tub. The nights were pleasantly warm, the days blazing hot, the mosquitoes were becoming a nuisance, and in spite of the clean clothes we had brought from Barcelona, we were almost immediately lousy. Out in the deserted orchards in no man's land, the cherries were whitening on the trees. There were more days of digging out the sticky clay with the wretched Spanish spades, which have no handles and bend like tin spoons. They'd promised us a trench mortar for the company. I was looking forward to it greatly. At nights, we patrolled as usual, more dangerous than it used to be, because the fascist trenches were better manned and they'd grown more alert. They'd scattered tin cans just outside their wire and used to open up with the machine guns when they heard a clank. In the daytime, we sniped from no man's land. By crawling 100 yards, you could get to a ditch hidden by tall grasses, which commanded a gap in the fascist parapet. We'd set up a rifle rest in the ditch. If you waited long enough, you generally saw a khaki-clad figure slip hurriedly across the gap. I had several shots. I don't know whether I hit anyone. It's most unlikely. I'm a very poor shot with a rifle. But it was rather fun. The fascists didn't know where the shots were coming from, and I made sure I'd get one of them sooner or later. However, the dog it was that died. A fascist sniper got me instead. I'd been about 10 days at the front when it happened. The whole experience of being hit by a bullet is very interesting, and I think it's worth describing in detail. It was at the corner of the parapet at 5 o'clock in the morning. This was always a dangerous time because we had the dawn at our backs, and if you stuck your head above the parapet, it was clearly outlined against the sky. I was talking to the sentries, preparatory to changing the guard. Suddenly, in the very middle of saying something, I felt... It's very hard to describe what I felt, though I remember it with the utmost vividness. Roughly speaking, it was the sensation of being at the centre of an explosion. There seemed to be a loud bang and a blinding flash of light all round me, and I felt a tremendous shock. No pain, only a violent shock such as you get from an electric terminal. With it, a sense of utter weakness, a feeling of being stricken and shriveled up to nothing. The sandbags in front of me receded into immense distance. I fancy you'd feel much the same if you were struck by lightning. I knew immediately that I was hit. But because of the seeming bang and flash, I thought it was a rifle nearby that had gone off accidentally and shot me. All this happened in a space of time much less than a second. The next moment, my knees crumpled up and I was falling, my head hitting the ground with a violent bang, which, to my relief, did not hurt. I had a numb, dazed feeling, a consciousness of being very badly hurt, but no pain in the ordinary sense. The American sentry I'd been talking to had started forward. "Gosh, are you hit?" People gathered round. There was the usual fuss. "Lift him up. Where's he hit? Get his shirt open," etc., etc. The American called for a knife to cut my shirt open. I knew that there was one in my pocket and tried to get it out, but discovered that my right arm was paralysed. Not being in pain, I felt a vague satisfaction. This ought to please my wife, I thought. She'd always wanted me to be wounded, which would save me from being killed when the great battle came. It was only now that it occurred to me to wonder where I was hit and how badly. I could feel nothing, but I was conscious that the bullet had struck me somewhere in the front of the body. When I tried to speak, I found that I had no voice, only a faint squeak. But at the second attempt, I managed to ask where I was hit. "In the throat," they said. Harry Webb, our stretcher-bearer, had brought a bandage and one of the little bottles of alcohol they gave us for field dressings. As they lifted me up, a lot of blood poured out of my mouth, and I heard a Spaniard behind me say that the bullet had gone clean through my neck. I felt the alcohol, which at ordinary times would sting like the devil, splash onto the wound as a pleasant coolness. They laid me down again while somebody fetched a stretcher. As soon as I knew that the bullet had gone clean through my neck, I took it for granted that I was done for. I'd never heard of a man or animal getting a bullet through the middle of the neck and surviving it. The blood was dribbling out of the corner of my mouth. "The artery's gone," I thought. I wondered how long you last when your carotid artery is cut. Not many minutes, presumably. Everything was very blurry. There must have been about 2 minutes during which I assumed that I was killed, and that too was interesting. I mean, it's interesting to know what your thoughts would be at such a time. My first thought, conventionally enough, was for my wife. My second was a violent resentment at having to leave this world, which, when all is said and done, suits me so well. I had time to feel this very vividly. The stupid mischance infuriated me. The meaninglessness of it. To be bumped off, not even in battle, but in this stale corner of the trenches thanks to a moment's carelessness. I thought, too, of the man who had shot me. Wondered what he was like, whether he was a Spaniard or a foreigner, whether he knew he had got me, and so forth. I could not feel any resentment against him. I reflected that as he was a fascist, I would have killed him if I could, but that if he had been taken prisoner and brought before me at this moment, I would merely have congratulated him on his good shooting. It may be, though, that if you were really dying, your thoughts would be quite different. They had just got me onto the stretcher when my paralysed right arm came to life and began hurting damnably. At the time, I imagined that I must have broken it in falling, but the pain reassured me, for I knew that your sensations do not become more acute when you're dying. I began to feel more normal and to be sorry for the four poor devils who were sweating and slithering with the stretcher on their shoulders. It was a mile and a half to the ambulance and vile going over lumpy, slippery tracks. I knew what a sweat it was, having helped to carry a wounded man down a day or two earlier. The leaves of the silver poplars, which in places fringed our trenches, brushed against my face. I thought what a good thing it was to be alive in a world where silver poplars grow. But all the while the pain in my arm was diabolical, making me swear and then try not to swear, because every time I breathed too hard the blood bubbled out of my mouth. The doctor re-bandaged the wound, gave me a shot of morphia, and sent me off to Sietamo. The hospitals at Sietamo were hurriedly constructed wooden huts, where the wounded were, as a rule, only kept for a few hours before being sent on to Barbastro or Lerida. I was dopey from morphia, but still in great pain, practically unable to move and swallowing blood constantly. It was typical of Spanish hospital methods that while I was in this state, the untrained nurse tried to force the regulation hospital meal, a huge meal of soup, eggs, greasy stew, and so forth, down my throat, and seemed surprised when I would not take it. I asked for a cigarette, but this was one of the periods of tobacco famine, and there was not a cigarette in the place. Presently, two comrades who had got permission to leave the line for a few hours appeared at my bedside. "Hello, you're alive, are you? Good. We want your watch and your revolver and your electric torch and your knife, if you've got one." They made off with all my portable possessions. This always happened when a man was wounded. Everything he possessed was promptly divided up. Quite rightly, for watches, revolvers, and so forth were precious at the front, and if they went down the line in a wounded man's kit, they were certain to be stolen somewhere on the way. By the evening, enough sick and wounded had trickled in to make up a few ambulance loads, and they sent us on to Barbastro. What a journey! It used to be said that in this war you got well if you were wounded in the extremities, but always died of a wound in the abdomen. I now realized why. No one who was liable to bleed internally could have survived those miles of jolting over metal roads that had been smashed to pieces by heavy lorries and never repaired since the war began. Bang, bump, wallop. It took me back to my early childhood and a dreadful thing called the Wiggle Woggle at the White City Exhibition. They had forgotten to tie us into the stretchers. I had enough strength in my left arm to hang on, but one poor wretch was spilt onto the floor and suffered God knows what agonies. Another, a walking case who was sitting in the corner of the ambulance, vomited all over the place. The hospital in Barbastro was very crowded, the beds so close together that they were almost touching. Next morning they loaded a number of us onto the hospital train and sent us down to Lerida. I was 5 or 6 days in Lerida. It was a big hospital with sick, wounded, and ordinary civilian patients more or less jumbled up together. Some of the men in my ward had frightful wounds. In the next bed to me there was a youth with black hair who was suffering from some disease or other, and was being given medicine that made his urine as green as emerald. His bed-bottle was one of the sights of the ward. An English-speaking Dutch communist, having heard there was an Englishman in the hospital, befriended me and brought me English newspapers. He had been terribly wounded in the October fighting, and had somehow managed to settle down at Lerida Hospital and had married one of the nurses. Thanks to his wound, one of his legs had shriveled till it was no thicker than my arm. Two militiamen on leave, whom I had met my first week at the front, came in to see a wounded friend and recognized me. They were kids of about 18. They stood awkwardly beside my bed, trying to think of something to say, and then, as a way of demonstrating that they were sorry I was wounded, suddenly took all the tobacco out of their pockets, gave it to me, and fled before I could give it back. How typically Spanish! I discovered afterwards that you could not buy tobacco anywhere in the town, and what they had given me was a week's ration. After a few days I was able to get up and walk about with my arm in a sling. For some reason it hurt much more when it hung down. I also had, for the time being, a good deal of internal pain from the damage I'd done myself in falling, and my voice had disappeared almost completely, but I never had a moment's pain from the bullet wound itself. It seems this is usually the case. The tremendous shock of a bullet prevents sensation locally. A splinter of shell or bomb, which is jagged and usually hits you less hard, would probably hurt like the devil. There was a pleasant garden in the hospital grounds, and in it was a pool with goldfishes and some small dark grey fish. Bleak, I think. I used to sit watching them for hours. The way things were done at Lerida gave me an insight into the hospital system on the Aragon front. Whether it was the same on other fronts, I don't know. In some ways, the hospitals were very good. The doctors were able men, and there seemed to be no shortage of drugs and equipment. But there were two bad faults on account of which, I have no doubt, hundreds or thousands of men have died who might have been saved. One was the fact that all the hospitals anywhere near the front line were used more or less as casualty clearing stations. The result was that you got no treatment there unless you were too badly wounded to be moved. In theory, most of the wounded were sent straight to Barcelona or Tarragona, but owing to the lack of transport, they were often a week or 10 days in getting there. They were kept hanging about at Sietamo, Barbastro, Monson, Lerida, and other places, and meanwhile they were getting no treatment except an occasional clean bandage. Sometimes not even that. Men with dreadful shell wounds, smashed bones and so forth, were swathed in a sort of casing made of bandages and plaster of Paris. A description of the wound was written in pencil on the outside, and as a rule the casing was not removed till the man reached Barcelona or Tarragona 10 days later. It was almost impossible to get one's wound examined on the way. The few doctors could not cope with the work, and they simply walked hurriedly past your bed, saying, "Yes, yes, they'll attend to you at Barcelona." There were always rumours that the hospital train was leaving for Barcelona mañana. The other fault was the lack of competent nurses. Apparently there was no supply of trained nurses in Spain, perhaps because before the war this work was done chiefly by nuns. I've no complaint against the Spanish nurses. They always treated me with the greatest kindness. But there is no doubt that they were terribly ignorant. All of them knew how to take a temperature, and some of them knew how to tie a bandage, but that was about all. The result was that men who were too ill to fend for themselves were often shamefully neglected. The nurses would let a man remain constipated for a week on end, and they seldom washed those who were too weak to wash themselves. I remember one poor devil with a smashed arm telling me that he had been 3 weeks without having his face washed. Even beds were left unmade for days together. The food in all the hospitals was very good. Too good, indeed. Even more in Spain than elsewhere, it seemed to be the tradition to stuff sick people with heavy food. At Lerida, the meals were terrific. Breakfast at about 6 in the morning consisted of soup, an omelette, stew, bread, white wine, and coffee. And lunch was even larger. This at a time when most of the civil population was seriously underfed. Spaniards seem not to recognize such a thing as a light diet. They give the same food to sick people as to well ones. Always the same rich, greasy cookery with everything sodden in olive oil. One morning it was announced that the men in my ward were to be sent down to Barcelona today. I managed to send a wire to my wife, telling her that I was coming, and presently they packed us into buses and took us down to the station. It was only when the train was actually starting that the hospital orderly who travelled with us casually let fall that we were not going to Barcelona after all, but to Tarragona. I suppose the engine driver had changed his mind. Just like Spain, I thought. But it was very Spanish, too, that they agreed to hold up the train while I sent another wire, and more Spanish still, that the wire never got there. They had put us into ordinary third-class carriages with wooden seats, and many of the men were badly wounded and had only got out of bed for the first time that morning. Before long, what with the heat and the jolting, half of them were in a state of collapse and several vomited on the floor. The hospital orderly threaded his way among the corpse-like forms that sprawled everywhere, carrying a large goatskin bottle full of water which he squirted into this mouth or that. It was beastly water. I remember the taste of it still. We got into Tarragona as the sun was getting low. The line runs along the shore, a stone's throw from the sea. As our train drew into the station, a troop train full of men from the International Column was drawing out, and a knot of people on the bridge were waving to them. It was a very long train, packed to bursting point with men, with field guns lashed on the open trucks, and more men clustering round the guns. I remember with peculiar vividness the spectacle of that train passing in the yellow evening sun. Window after window full of dark, smiling faces, the long, tilted barrels of the guns, the scarlet scarves fluttering. "Extranjeros, foreigners," said someone. "They're Italians." Obviously they were Italians. No other people could have grouped themselves so picturesquely, or returned the salute to the crowd with so much grace. A grace that was nonetheless because about half the men on the train were drinking out of upended wine bottles. We heard afterwards that these were some of the troops who had won the great victory at Guadalajara in March. They had been on leave and were being transferred to the Aragon front. Most of them, I'm afraid, were killed at Huesca only a few weeks later. The men who were well enough to stand had moved across the carriage to cheer the Italians as they went past. A crutch waved out of the window. Bandaged forearms made the red salute. It was like an allegorical picture of war. The trainload of fresh men gliding proudly up the line, the maimed men sliding slowly down, and all the while the guns on the open trucks making one's heart leap as guns always do, and reviving that pernicious feeling so difficult to get rid of that war is glorious, after all. The hospital at Tarragona was a very big one, and full of wounded from all fronts. What wounds one saw there! They had a way of treating certain wounds, which I suppose was in accordance with the latest medical practice, but which was peculiarly horrible to look at. This was to leave the wound completely open and unbandaged, but protected from flies by a net of butter muslin stretched over wires. Under the muslin you could see the red jelly of a half-healed wound. There was one man wounded in the face and throat, who had his head inside a sort of spherical helmet of butter muslin. His mouth was closed up, and he breathed through a little tube that was fixed between his lips. Poor devil, he looked so lonely, wandering to and fro, looking at you through his muslin cage and unable to speak. I was 3 or 4 days at Tarragona. My strength was coming back, and one day, by going slowly, I managed to walk down as far as the beach. It was queer to see the seaside life going on almost as usual, the smart cafes along the promenade, and the plump local bourgeoisie bathing and sunning themselves in deck chairs, as though there hadn't been a war within 1,000 miles. Nevertheless, as it happened, I saw a bather drowned, which one would have thought impossible in that shallow and tepid sea. Finally, 8 or 9 days after leaving the front, I had my wound examined. In the surgery, where newly arrived cases were examined, doctors with huge pairs of shears were hacking away the breastplates of plaster in which men with smashed ribs, collarbones, and so forth had been cased at the dressing stations behind the line. Out of the neck hole of the huge, clumsy breastplate you would see protruding an anxious, dirty face, scrubby with a week's beard. The doctor, a brisk, handsome man of about 30, sat me down in a chair, grasped my tongue with a piece of rough gauze, pulled it out as far as it would go, thrust a dentist's mirror down my throat, and told me to say, "Eh." After doing this till my tongue was bleeding and my eyes running with water, he told me that one vocal cord was paralyzed. "When shall I get my voice back?" I said. "Your voice? Oh, you'll never get your voice back," he said cheerfully. However, he was wrong, as it turned out. For about 2 months I couldn't speak much above a whisper, but after that my voice became normal rather suddenly, the other vocal cord having compensated. The pain in my arm was due to the bullet having pierced a bunch of nerves at the back of the neck. It was a shooting pain, like neuralgia, and it went on hurting continuously for about a month, especially at night, so that I did not get much sleep. The fingers of my right hand were also semi-paralyzed. Even now, 5 months afterwards, my forefinger's still numb. A queer effect for a neck wound to have. The wound was a curiosity in a small way, and various doctors examined it with much clicking of tongues and, "Qué suerte! Qué suerte!" One of them told me, with an air of authority, that the bullet had missed the artery by about a millimetre. I don't know how he knew. No one I met at this time, doctors, nurses, practicantes, or fellow patients, failed to assure me that a man who is hit through the neck and survives it is the luckiest creature alive. I couldn't help thinking that it would be even luckier not to be hit at all.